Israeli warplanes launched airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, hitting targets south of Gaza City. A spokesman for an Iraqi resistance movement said that Iraqi resistance groups are capable of retaliating U.S. attacks. Also ahead, Bahraini opposition group the Al-Wafaq Society calls on the Al Khalifa regime to release all the political prisoners. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour is the Israeli army has carried out airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, hitting areas south of Gaza City. No casualties have been reported so far. Tel Aviv claims the air raid was in response to Palestinians sending incendiary balloons towards the occupied territories. The strike follows Israel's 11-day aggression against Gaza in May. The conflict ended on May the 21st after a ceasefire. Nearly 260 Palestinians, half of them women and children, were killed. Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel in response, killing a dozen people. The spokesman for Iraq's al-Nujaba resistance movement said that Iraqi resistance forces are capable of retaliating against the recent U.S. attack on the country's popular mobilization units.
Hajj al-Shabi, or the popular mobilization units, try to acquire military equipment that can defend defend their country and can boost the deterrence of their country. That's why Hajj al-Shabi is capable right now to retaliate and attain and acquire aerial armament to stand against the American troops. And
Shamari said the recent U.S. attack was a terrorist attack. The spokesman urged the United States to withdraw its troops from the country. He noted that the presence of American forces in Iraq is illegal. Last year, Iraqi lawmakers unanimously passed a bill mandating the expulsion of all foreign troops from the country. The spokesman also called on the Iraqi government to take a stronger position against U.S. attacks on PMU forces.
These violations has a number of reasons. The first reason is that the Iraqi government is weak. Now in Iraq, we need to take a real stance to summon the American ambassador and condemn such an act of aggression against the Iraqi sovereignty, and to hold the American government responsible for such a violation of our sovereignty.
Shamari said the U.S. failed in its attempts to pit Iraq's army against the PMU forces. He added that Washington now wants to take the matters into its own hands and deal a blow to resistance groups. The U.S. targeted positions of the resistance forces along the Iraqi-Syrian border. On Monday, the PMU says four of its members were killed in the airstrikes. Well, political commentator Scott Bennett says the recent U.S. airstrikes in Iraq is part of a broader campaign by Biden administration to gain more access to the military.
This is an attempt to provoke an exchange that can then allow Biden to have more direct access to the U.S. military, which he has been currently cut off from. That's why they're trying to provoke Russia and the Black Sea. That's why they're trying to provoke Iran and Iraq. The Israeli Zionist Mossad, of course, are the ones that are flying drones and attacking U.S. troops, and that knows that, and they simply use that as an excuse to engage in these not just terrorist attacks, but I would say declarations of war. And they really should be enunciated and diplomatically communicated to the instruments of power around the world as such. And it is an information war. So psychological war means to question the morality of things is to bring the morality of it into the light, where the U.S. has always fallen down and has obscured and run into the shadows of slogans such as human rights and world peace and, you know, counterterrorism, where in fact it has been destabilizing the world with violence. It has been encouraging and funding terrorism, and it has been declaring war ever since 2001.
Yemenis have held a protest in front of the UN office in the capital. They demanded the lifting of the siege and called on the international community to take action. Abdul Latif Al-Washari has more in this report.
Yemen's Ministry of Electricity held a sit-in protest in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a to call on the international community to step in and pressure Saudi Arabia to stop detaining Yemeni oil vessels. The ministry said it is unable to generate power anymore due to the lack of fuel.
Electricity is an essential service and has nothing to do with any political conflicts. The power sector in Yemen has been heavily affected since the first moment of the war. The Saudi-led coalition has directly targeted all electric power plants, and this is a great tragedy for us. The UN has not done anything to end the suffering of Yemenis. We demand the lifting of the siege and releasing the oil ships so we can generate electricity again.
At the same place, Yemeni children organized a gallery for the drawings. The gallery was named The U.S. Kills Our Childhood and exhibited children's drawings that show the suffering of Yemeni children due to the ongoing conflict.
We participated in this protest to tell the United Nations, which classified Ansarullah in its blacklist of groups violating children's rights. We Yemenis demand our rights like any other people, on top of which is the lifting of the siege imposed on us by Saudi Arabia.
How many fathers and mothers have lost their children? This is a massive crime. This is tyranny. We are little children. We have no fault.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on the impoverished country in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, and imposing an all-out blockade.
Yemenis have held hundreds of protests in front of the United Nations office, but the international body has not yet taken any strict measures to end the suffering of the millions of Yemenis. That is why the UN describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Elsewhere, Bahrain's main opposition group has called for the immediate release of all political inmates kept in the Al Khalifa regime's prisons. In a statement issued on Thursday, the Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society noted that the rift between the Manama regime and the people of Bahrain is deep. The group slammed the Al Khalifa regime for using violence against the pro-democracy campaign in the country. It stressed that the right to freedom of expression and peaceful assembly formed the backbone of public demands. Al-Wafaq also demanded the release of former Bahraini lawmaker Osama Al-Tamimi and stressed the need to provide all medical requirements and humanitarian needs for the political prisoner. Bahrain has come under pressure from human rights organizations over prison conditions, including overcrowding, poor sanitation, and a lack of medical care. Political commentator Colin Cavell says there is neither an independent judiciary system nor a fair trial in Bahrain.
The Kingdom of Bahrain, this regime headed up by one family, the Al Khalifa family, there is no democracy that determines how the politics of the country operate. There is no freedom of speech in Bahrain. There is no freedom to believe what you want to believe. The government will dictate what is allowed, what confessions are allowed. There is no freedom of association, nor peaceful assembly. There's no freedom from arbitrary detainment, no due process, no fair trials, no independent judiciary system. What Al-Wafaq is doing today is reminding the world to not forget the political prisoners and those that have been executed in Bahrain, the political prisoners that still remain in Jah prison, that still remain in the holding centers, that still remain in the torture chambers and dungeons of Bahrain. and have to endure hardship every day while standing strong for eventual freedom of the country.
The United States says withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan does not mean Washington intends to abandon the country. State Department spokesman Ned Price said the U.S. intends to maintain a diplomatic presence in Kabul. He added that Washington wants to have a continued partnership with the Afghan government and the Afghan people. U.S. President Joe Biden had declared the withdrawal of all American soldiers from Afghanistan by September 11th. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 under the pretext of the so-called War on Terror. But despite two decades of presence, the U.S. failed to quell violence and ensure security in the war-torn country. Germany has completed the pullout of its troops from Afghanistan, and Italy has also followed suit as part of an accelerated NATO withdrawal from the war-torn country. As the security situation worsens, speculation is rife that other countries with smaller contingents will do the same in the coming days. The US has also pledged to withdraw its remaining troops by September 11th. These are the last German soldiers to withdraw from Afghanistan. Over the last couple of years, Germany had the second largest contingent of troops after the United States. The German defense minister says that after nearly 20 years of deployment, the last soldiers left Afghanistan. Annegret Kramp-Karren Bauer added that this is the end of a historic chapter of an intensive mission. 59 German soldiers died in Afghanistan, 35 of them had been killed in combat or as a result of militant attack, making it Germany's deadliest military mission since World War II. Looking back, the minister vowed to discuss where it went wrong and what Berlin has learned.
We've not only accomplished nothing, we have grievously damaged Afghan society over the last 20 years of bombing and so on and so forth. There was never a political coalition in Afghanistan to support the United States, even less so than in Vietnam, in my opinion.
Because of the security problems in Afghanistan and the increasing levels of violence, the German military kept the details of its withdrawal vague. Berlin sent its forces in the wake of the 9/11 attacks on the US in 2001. Meanwhile, British media reports suggest the majority of British troops have quietly withdrawn from Afghanistan. Again, Britain withdrawing its forces, if confirmed, would have been shrouded in secrecy. According to the latest UN report, US-led forces, in particular Germany and Italy and the UK, are leaving Afghanistan while the country remains in bad shape. Violence is on the rise and Afghans are facing multiple crises, including rising poverty, which could increase from 50% to 70%. These all suggest that over two decades of foreign military presence has failed to bring peace to Afghanistan. In mid-April, US President Joe Biden and NATO announced they would pull out the roughly 10,000 foreign troops still in Afghanistan at the time by September 11, marking the 20th anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York that sparked the invasion of the country itself. The mission had been aimed at toppling the then ruling Taliban government. 20 years later, Washington has been negotiating with the militant group itself on the best way to withdraw. During those 20 years, Afghans have witnessed a spiral of violence and terror.
It's obvious that this 20 years here hasn't benefited the Afghans in any way. Here we are with 2,500 troops left, more or less, who knows, you know, thousands of contractors, and several different things have come out in the newspaper in the last week. One, in spite of all this alleged training and so on and so forth, the only thing that is flyable in Afghanistan right now over the next few weeks are the Russian-made helicopters.
Meanwhile, U.S. officials speaking to CNN on condition of anonymity indicated that America itself may complete its withdrawal within days. One of official says the Pentagon is considering keeping at least 650 troops in the country to safeguard the American embassy and Kabul airport. This comes as violence has sharply increased between Taliban militants and government forces since the U.S. missed a May withdrawal deadline agreed between the militants group and the former U.S. administration of Donald Trump. According to the Pentagon, the Taliban are now estimated to be in control of 81 districts out of the country's 419. There are fears of a looming civil war as the warring sides struggle to clinch a possible power-sharing peace deal during intra-Afghan negotiations. Now, the United States federal deficit this year is projected to hit $3 trillion, one of the highest recorded in American history. The new figure released by the Congressional Budget Office is slightly lower than that of the last year, but three times more than the one in 2019. The Budget Office attributed the rise to the country's response to the COVID-19 pandemic and President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion coronavirus stimulus package. The federal agency expects the U.S. government to start to earn more revenue after the pandemic ends and the nation returns to normal. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, meanwhile, has nominated the members of a special congressional panel probing the January 6th attack on the Capitol building. Former President Donald Trump's prominent critics, including Republican Representative Liz Cheney, are on the list. On January 6th, a mob of Trump supporters stormed the Capitol while Congress was holding sessions to officially certify President Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 race. The attack left five people dead, including a Capitol Police officer. Trump's critics say his incendiary remarks during a speech on the same day encouraged his supporters to storm Congress. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Delta variant of SARS-CoV-2, first identified in India, has become the most common strain in the UK over the past few weeks.
and is spreading rapidly as a result of its being more transmissible than the Alpha variant responsible for the January 2021 wave. The number of infections is doubling every 7 to 10 days at present, says Charlotte Summers, writer, in an article published under the heading, "Even with delay in England's lockdown lifting, COVID cases and deaths will still rise." Stay tuned for more. The British Prime Minister has announced that England is not yet able to remove the final public health measures that are in place because of the COVID-19 pandemic, and that these measures are likely to remain until July 19th. So why is this step needed, and what are the potential benefits of an additional 4 weeks of restrictions? Will this be enough to prevent a further wave? The Delta variant of SARS-CoV-2, first identified in India, has become the most common strain in the UK over the past few weeks and is spreading rapidly as a result of its being more transmissible than the Alpha variant responsible for the January 2021 wave. The number of infections is doubling every 7 to 10 days at present. The Delta variant also appears more likely to require hospital admission than the previous variants, and the number of people being admitted to hospital and to intensive care is on the rise once again. Today, there are around 1,000 people in hospital with confirmed COVID-19 in England, 160 of them requiring mechanical ventilation. That's the equivalent of around 10 medium-sized intensive care units just for people with COVID-19. The easing of public health measures over the past few months was always going to result in an increased number of SARS-CoV-2 infections, more people having more social interactions and in closer proximity increases the chance of viral transmission. Yet there are still concerns about the rising number of people testing positive for the virus. To date, 57% of UK adults have received 2 doses of a COVID vaccine and 79% have received a single dose, but around 4.5 million of the former received their second dose in the past 2 weeks, so have not yet developed optimal immune protection. Taking away the public health restrictions now would result in a significant further increase in viral transmission. And given that approximately half Britain's adults have yet to be fully immunized, removing the restrictions now would result in a substantial number of people needing hospital admission and even dying in the coming weeks. A delay until July 19th before releasing the restrictions will allow all those aged over 50. And those who are clinically extremely vulnerable to have second doses and for those vaccinations to have taken effect. And by then, it is likely that old adults will have been offered their first dose of the vaccines and 2/3 will have had a second dose, which is likely to reduce hospital admissions by between 30% and 50%. Yet it is important to be clear that the restrictions that have already been relaxed over the past few months are likely to lead to further increases in infections, hospitalizations and deaths in the coming weeks. The pause announced by Boris Johnson recently means the British have taken their foot off the accelerator but not applied the brakes. The four-week delay also means British are due to end restrictions as the school summer holidays begin. While it is critically important for children to be in the classroom, it is inescapable that schools are a setting where there is increased viral transmission. There is little social distancing in the classroom, and pupils are no longer required to wear masks. It is possible that in the autumn, when students return for the new academic year, the British may need to revisit what measures are needed in the schools. The past 18 months have been tough for all the British. They have stayed at home, provided homeschooling for their children by trying to hold down jobs, suffered financial hardships, and in many cases endured grief while remaining isolated from friends and families. It has been challenging on almost every front. It is naive to think that life will return to exactly as it was prior to the pandemic. After all, we have experience. How could it be? The biggest risk for the future is that most of the world has yet to be vaccinated, and in many places, viral transmission is raging at unacceptably high levels.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have two special guests and friends. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, sister.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullahi. I am Sister Nasreen, and I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so very much, Sister Nasreen. Though your accent makes it quite obvious, just for, you know, our listeners to get more in tune with the vibe of our discussion, can I ask where you're from and what you've your studies have been?
I'm born in England, and I'm studying Masters in Philosophy of Ethics.
MashaAllah. Thank you so
applied
very
ethics,
much.
Actually.
Thank you so much for that information. And my other lovely guest is...
Assalamu alaikum, dear sister. I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK. I'm studying here in the holy city of Qom, studying Islam, and I'm at your service today.
Thank you so very much for joining us, Brother Muzaffar, Sister Nasreen. It's an absolute pleasure and honor. Today we're going to be talking about life isn't always full of rainbows and butterflies, right? I don't think there's anyone on this earth that wouldn't agree with me. And then as we get older, those problems and struggles become bigger. But then as we get older, our achievements and success in life become bigger and more significant and profound as well.
Hopefully.
Often when my brother's children, they do something awesome in their eyes. And, you know, really for kids, it's really something awesome what they did. And they run to me. The first question is like, Auntie, are you proud of me? That's what they want, right? To be acknowledged, to hear words of affirmation, to be reassured that they are worthy, they are valuable. So my question for today's discussion is, what aspects of our lives do we still have that we are, in fact, proud of as adults?
I don't use the word proud.
Okay, let's explore that.
Yeah, the word proud, I believe, and there are different opinions even within the Islamic framework of thinking. But I personally don't like the word proud because it can be misinterpreted and misguided and end up in a slippery slope kind of situation. So, you know, to be thankful, to be guided in a certain direction, I think that is more appropriate for anything that we achieve in life. Not to take anything back to the self, but to be grateful that you've had the guidance to arrive at a certain station with a certain, even if it's a material thing like a, you know, a house that can help you achieve your Islamic goals. You know, this pride is a sort of a fire signal.
Absolutely. That is such a beautiful perspective toward the whole thing, that rather, you know, practice gratitude and thankfulness instead of being proud of a certain achievement that actually does sometimes make you feel feel warm and fuzzy and elated on the inside. But it, like you said, it can get so risky, so scary sometimes because it gets messy.
I think what it does is it kills our heart little by little.
Without us having
that,
it,
you know, so that we... You know, I visualize things, that I visualize that blackness growing of every pride. You know, even, for example, you know, brother Sheikh Muzaffar is on the social media. Allah is the one who chooses the people who go out there, because we can be in the proud situation in a high profile, or we can be in the, I'm just doing my job, you know?
Right.
I'm grateful to be spreading the word of Islam, that Allah has given me the ability to voice
His message,
to voice my beliefs, the knowledge that I have
obtained.
That
really is a blessing and a tawfiq. Brother Muzaffar, we can change, we can use I'm proud and I'm thankful interchangeably, all right, in the context of today's discussion, because safe place. But there are, have you had moments in your life where you feel like, okay, I'm proud of what I did, or alhamdulillah that I was given the tawfiq to do what I did?
I'd actually like to thank Sister Nasreen for making that much more easier, because when you say proud, it's very difficult to say I'm proud of doing this. I'd like to think about things way back before I even came to the holy city of Qom. Those things, maybe because I'm so distant from it now, it's easier for me to say, yeah, I'm proud of that. I would always
proud. Let's use proud as the opposite of ashamed, right?
Ah, that's it, right?
I'm not ashamed of what I did. Like, I'm cool with that. I'm satisfied with what the decision I made at that moment.
So there was this kid, he was being bullied in school, and I stood up for him.
Definitely.
If I had not stood up for him,
you've been ashamed.
I would have been very ashamed of myself.
For sure.
You know? So yeah, that's one thing. Definitely, I'm very proud of that. And I'd say that throughout my school time, whenever I saw somebody was being picked on or somebody was being hurt or abused or in any way, alhamdulillah, Allah always gave me the tawfiq to stand up for that person. I could never ever tolerate it.
MashaAllah.
So alhamdulillah.
What is your opinion, however, regarding the matter of, because there's a hadith, I think, from Amir al-Mu'mineen, could be Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, kulluhum nurul wahid, they're all the same light in essence. Where His Eminence says, a sin that makes you feel remorseful is better than a good deed that makes you feel proud and arrogant,
exactly,
right? And gives
exactly
you ujb. So I'm thinking, from your personal experience, what can you share with our younger audience, people who are trying to strive in this path, bettering themselves? Like Sister Nasreen said, voicing their beliefs in the message of Allah through different platforms to be able to create that balance, you know, not feel ashamed, but don't get caught up in the pride and the limelight either.
This path, when you come onto the path of doing tabligh and becoming a muballigh of Islam, whether you're a man, whether you're a woman, whether you're old, whether you're young, it doesn't matter, whoever you are, when you start to speak about the religion, you automatically start to present yourself as a religious person.
Oh yeah.
Right? And that's where the danger is.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
I'm sure you guys have experience with it, where you see people, youths or anybody, they're spreading the religion, they're giving speeches or they're reciting poetry, whatever it is, a religious act, and you see them like shining with this, not pride, with
arrogance. And it's it makes you feel like it makes you want to gag.
That's a very, very good point. Mm-hmm. That one who speaks or one who does a service for Islam or anything, even whether it's teaching philosophy, or we should act as a journalist.
Mm.
That, you know, this is what they said, this is the information, this is, you know, and just bring it out there. But we are not the representative of that.
Right.
You know, and you know what? I think that when we're talking about shame and pride, to be in a position of humility at every time actually helps us to rise.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
And have confidence in what we're, you know, it's just something that recently I was tested with, you know, because I have a problem with confidence, and I had to figure it out in psychological ways that, you know, as long as you give this demeanor that I'm talking about the matter, it's not about, you know, the one who's delivering it, then it gives you confidence and it keeps you humble.
That's a perfect
balance. You know?
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Back to Reality. We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
I'm here in the studio with my special guest, my awesome brother and my wonderful sister. We're talking about points in our lives, times in our lives where we felt proud of ourselves, and we're making it our life objective within this 15 minutes to define what proud of myself actually means.
Yeah, I want to deal with the idea of guilt and shame. Firstly, it's the lowest vibration on a human spectrum of frequencies. So when you keep a person at the level of guilt and shame, they can't rise, you know, and they become very selfish because they're constantly introspecting. But when in Islam, and also Carl Jung has the same method as we use, as Allah has given us in Islam, that when you feel that feeling of guilt or shame, you really, sometimes you don't know what to do with it because it burns.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly the feeling it gives
and
you.
And it affects your whole emotional, and that emotion just spreads into the physical and the mental. What to do with that, right? And Imam Zain al-Abidin, alayhi salam, it's not what he said now, but it's conceptual. He has a whole book of remedies, not just like intellectual remedies, but if you just, you see, the emotion is the center of the cognitive function and the behavioral function. So if you take that feeling of shame and just admit it and send it out to Allah, because it's got to have an output, then you feel relieved because you've admitted it in front of the highest and most merciful creator. And he said, I am the forgiving, the all forgiving. It's gone from you as long as you admit it.
Mm.
You know, so this is why we should not, you know, hold on to pride without dealing with our shame and our guilt and saying, it's okay. Feel it, admit it, release it.
Mm.
But release it where? You know?
Exactly, from to the proper...
Not with people.
Exactly. They reminded me of other religions that have that outlet going on.
Confession?
But
anybody can go and spread that further. And, you know, and I want, even, you know, speaking to a psychologist, I was thinking, sorry, but this is my thesis and I'm constantly thinking about these matters, that when you go to a psychologist, he's going to give you advice or responses or body language according to his level of understanding and knowledge.
For sure.
When you release it to Allah through the Imam, you've gone to the highest realm of human understanding, and divine.
Yes, human understanding.
That is your healer.
Human understanding through a divine capacity. So that just does wonders for your body, mind, and soul.
Shame. How do you deal with it? Shame, shame, shame. Istighfar.
Oh, yeah.
You do istighfar, and then your shame theoretically should leave if you do istighfar truthfully, and you trust that Allah will forgive you if you're deserving of it.
Mm.
You know,
the worst thing to do with shame, by the way, is to bury it.
Exactly.
To bury it, to pretend
exactly.
It doesn't exist.
Rush it, put it under the carpet, because that is going to have a big fire afterwards, and it can lead to some very serious, even, you know, you don't know where it'll lead you if you flush it under the carpet.
Also, don't always think of shame as a bad thing. It can be a good thing. There are people out there who are shameless, quote unquote, right? That's a really bad thing, to have no shame.
Yeah, no, with the feeling. Yeah. It's a feeling of shame that we're trying to deal with.
True.
That burn.
You've done something wrong.
Like shame as in feeling guilt.
Done something wrong, you should feel guilty.
Something you can't change that has affected other people, for example. You know, as a mother, we are the examples of the bags of shame. You know, that, you know, oh my God, it's going to have this image for the rest of their life. And because I did this and I wasn't able to change it, and oh my God, you know. So, you know, you want to ask someone about shame, ask someone.
You never felt like going to somebody and saying, brother, you should be ashamed of yourself, because they're not ashamed of the thing that they've done wrong. They're just proudly like,
right.
Be ashamed, for crying out loud.
Exactly.
It's good for you. See, shame is
the
good
Holy
thing.
Prophet
right,
said
if
that if you take away a person's shame, he can do anything.
This shame that is often used in the English language because of the lack of a better equivalent, I think, is haya. It's the concept of haya we have in Islam. And haya in Islam goes so much beyond modesty and chastity and hijab and, you know, even hijab. It's about having that proper amount of self-respect, self-worth as the Ashraf al-Makhluqat, as the best creation of Allah. This action is beneath me because I am watched by the all-knowing, all-seeing, the exalted Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you so very much, you guys, for your time. And thank you to our audience for being with us on today's episode of Back to Reality. Until next time, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
limelight.
U.S. officials in Miami are calling for inspections of all older buildings over six stories within 45 days after the collapse of the Champlain Towers South apartment building that it is now feared to have killed potentially scores of people. Here we present you an article concerning this issue written by Amanda Holpach under the heading, Miami Condo Collapse. Death toll rises to 10 as search and rescue operations continue. The article was published by The Guardian Daily. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. The rescue operation in the Miami suburb of Surfside continued. Officials urged people to maintain hope survivors might be found in the wreckage of a collapsed condo building. At a briefing, the Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava announced that a 10th person had been confirmed dead and 151 were still missing. No survivors had been found since Thursday, June 24th, in the ruins of Champlain Tower South, with rescue teams conducting round-the-clock searches. Levine Cava said they're out there with every resource that they need to ensure they can search this area, adding they can sweep the mound with dogs, with cameras, and sonar. The mayor said 135 residents had been accounted for and that the numbers of deceased and missing people were still very fluid. Andy Alvarez, a deputy incident commander with Miami-Dade Fire Rescue, told ABC on Monday, June 28, rescuers were still hopeful. Alvarez said, "This is a frantic search to continue to see that hope, that miracle, to see who we can bring out of this building alive." Alvarez said rescue teams found some voids in the wreckage, mostly in the basement and near the parking garage. Alvarez said, "We have over 80 rescuers at a time that are breaching the walls that collapse. In a frantic effort to try to rescue those that are still viable and to get to those voids that we typically know exist in these buildings." Alvarez said conditions were not ideal because of humidity, rain, and heat. Alvarez noted, "We are holding up because we are holding up for that hope, that faith, that we are going to be able to rescue somebody," adding, "We are working tirelessly to try to bring victims that are underneath that rubble and rescue them." The search includes more than 300 emergency personnel, international expats, and equipment, including underground sonar systems. Efforts are also underway to determine the cause of the collapse. Structural engineers have identified several theories, but determining the cause could take months or years. In 2018, an engineer flagged concerns about major structural damage at the tower, but the report did not indicate the building was at risk of collapse. The engineering report, dated 8 October 2018, appeared to have been discussed at a board meeting of Champlain Tower South Condominium Association the next month. According to meeting minutes obtained by NPR, at a November meeting, a Surfside building official said the building is in very good shape. The building collapsed at about 1:30 a.m. local time on Thursday, June 24th. No survivors have been found since the first hours following the collapse. Rescuers dug a trench 125 feet long, 20 feet across, and 40 feet deep overnight on Saturday, June 29th, and found remains, but no survivors. Families of the missing traveled by bus on Sunday, June 27th, to a site where they could watch rescue teams dig through the rubble and move large sections with cranes. An official who accompanied the families told the Miami Herald several people yelled the names of their loved ones in the hopes they might hear. Diane O'Hagan, whose parents Miriam and Arnie Nokin were in the building, told the Associated Press, "We're just waiting for answers. That's what we want. It's hard to go through these long days, and we haven't gotten any answers yet." Alan Kaminsky, chief of the Miami-Dade Fire Rescue Department, emphasized the operation must be slow and careful to protect rescuers as well as any survivors. Kaminsky said that we can't just go in and move things erratically because that's going to have the worst outcome possible. At a White House press briefing on Monday, June 28, the press secretary Jen Psaki said Joe Biden wanted the federal government involved in an investigation of the collapse. Officials from several federal bodies, including the FBI and Occupational Safety and Health Administration, have been deployed to the scene. Psaki said, "We want to play any constructive role we can play with federal resources in getting to the bottom of it and preventing it from happening in the future." Surfside has hired a structural engineer, Alan Kushmer, who examined the Pentagon after it was attacked on 9/11 to study the tower collapse and the condition of nearby buildings. According to the town, Kushmer, founder and chief executive of KCE Structural Engineers, has toured the site and saw no visible evidence of any major structural concern. The Champlain Towers North Condominium Association has told the town it will hire its own structural engineering firm to investigate. The latest four victims identified by police were Christina Beatriz Elvira, 74, Leon Olikowitz, 80, Anna Ortiz, 46, and Luis Bermudez, 26. Bermudez lived on the 7th floor of the building with his mother, Ortiz. Officials in Miami are calling for inspections of all older buildings over six stories within 45 days after the collapse of Champlain Towers South apartment building. The sudden failure of the building stunned the U.S., happening incredibly quickly and as most of its residents slept. According to CNN, the city of Miami sent letters on Friday, June 25th, to condo associations of 40-plus-year-old buildings above six stories, urging them to get an inspection from a qualified structural engineer within the next 45 days. The letter said, "Effective immediately, you are strongly urged to retain the services of a licensed structural engineer and to undertake a structural inspection for visible signs of distress." Miami-Dade and Surfside officials have vowed to release all documents relating to Champlain Towers to get to the bottom of what happened, as fires in the rubble have hampered efforts to reach possible survivors. Although the cause of the collapse remains to be unknown, engineering experts interviewed by the Miami Herald have said that, based on available evidence, it appeared that a structural column or concrete slab beneath the pool deck failed, creating a crater into which the midsection of the building collapsed. According to the minutes from a November 2018 board meeting obtained by the Miami Herald, Rosendo Prieto, the chief building official for the town of Surfside, told residents the condominium was in very good shape, just a month after an engineer highlighted abandoned cracking in concrete columns, beams, and walls in a field survey report. The 136-unit building erected in 1981 collapsed before a recertification process was completed. But emails released by Surfside also show that Prieto dismissed concerns over potential damage to the building's foundation from a nearby construction project just 2 months after the engineer's report. According to the Washington Post, separately, developers of the complex were accused of contributing to at least 2 town board members' campaigns to get help with permits during construction in 1981. Champlain Towers were in a partnership with Polish-born Canadian Nathan Raber. According to Ontario's Hamilton Spectator, Raber was charged with tax evasion by Canadian authorities in 1970s. In 1970, faced with a moratorium on construction in Surfside due to sewer system problems, rival developers with stalled projects complained that Raber's Champlain Towers project had received preferential treatment for permits. A year later, developers at Champlain requested that 2 members of Surfside's town council return political contributions that has been made to them after Raber's rivals went public. Raber died in 2014. Beyond immediate questions about the cause of the Champlain Towers collapse are broader questions of Miami's long beachfront development, often built on reclaimed land or sensitive barrier islands. Reports have identified parts of northeast Miami Beach where the ground has sunk, though experts stress it is far too early to make any meaningful guesses as to the exact cause of the collapse. Shimon Wedowinski, an environment professor at Florida International University, co-authored a paper in April last year that found the building had sunk by about 2 millimeters per year since 1990s. Wedowinski said it came as no surprise given his research last year. He told USA Today, "I looked at it this morning and said, oh my God, we did detect that." A construction executive who has extensive experience building high-rises in New York told The Guardian that everything moves no matter where it is constructed. He said, "Sure, buildings in Florida take a beating from the hurricanes and rain. If corners were cut, they will have to investigate what was in the ground and what kind of foundations was it built on."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.